Thanks for joining me. My name is Mike Bruska. I'm a partner at Davis & Bruska. And since I came out of the service in 2009, I have consistently represented families and the elderly in nursing home neglect and abuse cases, exclusively almost. Today, I want to talk about a very serious problem that I see in facilities consistently, and those are falls. Falls are classified by Medicare and Medicaid services as the leading cause of mortality and morbidity in older adults. That is, the largest causer of injuries and death in the elderly is caused by falls. Now, falls are very serious because as people age, they start to lose their ability to react quickly to emergencies. And so, whereas a younger person would fall, and instantly, without even thinking about it, brace themselves with their hands, the elderly don't have that ability. As a consequence, when younger people fall, they fracture their hands and their wrists and their arms. The elderly fracture their hips, shoulders, and skulls. They don't have that ability to very quickly put their hands out and prevent the fall from being catastrophic. So these falls are a problem because they typically lead to very serious fractures, in particular a hip fracture, because it'll cause immobility. And when people aren't moving, their bodies decondition rapidly. And the older you get, the quicker that process occurs. So if you're not able to move around, you're not able to just simply walk around, you will begin to decondition. Your muscles will atrophy, that is, they get smaller. And so the outcome can be devastating. I think the statistics are that in the elderly, when there is a hip fracture, death often will occur within 6 months. When you do have a different type of injury, it will cause oftentimes a fear of falling, and oftentimes people don't want to walk then. You'll see a recalcitrance or a pushback on walking if a person's had a fall with an injury because they're afraid they're going to fall and injure themselves again. And that fear of falling will also in turn cause that kind of immobility. Of course, head strikes can be absolutely devastating because the head strikes are not softened. Oftentimes the brain will be injured. It can cause brain bleeds, even when there's no skull fracture. Now, these can be very, very serious. And in particular, I have had multiple cases over the years where people have a fall in the facility, no one in the staff sees it, they just assume the person's okay, they don't do the proper tests like pupil dilation, right, or neurotesting, or they're just not paying attention. That often happens, the person starts vomiting later and the brain bleed is too large to fix or has already caused the damage. And it's critical, if you do have that kind of injury, to get out to the hospital immediately. And in particular, if you have a fall with a potential head strike and the person has cognitive impairment or dementia, they can't tell you what happened, the facility should have them out to the hospital out of precautionary measures because the downside is so dangerous. So the consequences of falls in the elder can be absolutely devastating. And so these are very serious injuries. And of course, if you go to the Nursing Home Compare website, and there is an overall star rating in three subcategories. One of those subcategories is quality measures. And these are quality of care indicators. That is, things that CMS says, if these are too high, they may be indicative of the type of care they're delivering in that facility. And falls with a major injury is one of the indicators. So CMS takes this very seriously. Good nursing homes take this seriously. And people that practice with the elderly in medicine take this very seriously. So are falls inevitable? The answer to that question is no, they're not inevitable. I often hear this. Oh, listen, people fall. It just happens. It happens absent negligence. Well, one of those two statements is true. Falls can happen absent negligence. But many falls are preventable if the proper interventions are in place and your facility is staffed up in order to provide those proper interventions. So having a fall is not a foregone conclusion. If you have a loved one that's at risk for falls, it's important to understand what the facility is doing to prevent them. I've seen different philosophies on some of the interventions I'm going to discuss with you. I will tell you that some of these philosophies that indicate that maybe we shouldn't do these things were not presented to the family. And I can assure you the family wouldn't have asked for that intervention had they had the option, right? That is, the facility made a decision. Well, we have a philosophy, we don't use that intervention, and the family didn't know about it. And I can assure you that the family would have chosen to have that intervention. So understanding the world of interventions that are out there is important when you go to your care conference meeting, because if you don't hear some of these things and your concerns are not dealt with, then I would raise them. All right, so the most important intervention is increased supervision. All right, now you can only do that with staff. That's it, generally speaking. There are some tools, modern tools now with cameras, although I don't see them that often for people. And so increased staffing, increased rounding, in particular with people that are high risk for falls, are known to not ask for help, is really important. I've seen this particular intervention many, many times in a care plan, and it'll say, encouraged to use the call bell. That is a meaningless intervention when you have someone with cognitive impairment. Because when you have either Alzheimer's or dementia, one thing they have in common is there is no short-term memory. All right, so you can go in there and say, good morning, Jane. Make sure to use your call bell if you need to use the restroom or go to the bathroom. And she'll say, got it, sure. And then it's gone, okay? And then 5 minutes later, she has the urge to go to the bathroom and gets up on her own without asking for help. That intervention is absolutely meaningless when you have people with cognitive impairment. I don't know why they write it down. It sounds good, but it is completely meaningless. So you have to increase your supervision on those folks that you know do that, because they will know who does that kind of thing. Which leads me to my next point. Many falls happen when people get up to use the bathroom and don't ask for help. It's very common, very, very common. So one thing that a facility can do is anticipate when a person needs to go to the bathroom and then put them on a schedule where they're doing that. This is a very powerful tool because it eliminates one of the main reasons that people with cognitive impairment are getting up without asking for help, right? So if you know that Jane gets up at around 7 o'clock in the morning, she's going to want to go to the bathroom. So before you do AM care, check in on Jane at this time, make sure she gets to the bathroom. Many people want to go before lunch or after lunch, right? These are very common times when people are going to want to use the restroom. And knowing your residents and having the staff to accomplish that task are critical. So toileting schedule is another intervention that can help prevent falls. Now, the next one I want to talk about are what are called position change alarms. Position change alarms are an intervention, and you will see them commonly in hospitals, where if you have a person that's a very high risk for falls, when they either get out of a chair or get out of bed, an alarm will sound to let the staff know that someone at risk for falls is now walking about and in danger. All right. Now, this particular intervention ties back into my previous one in that the alarm itself doesn't prevent the fall, right? It only notifies the staff that someone is at risk for falls now. So those alarms are only as good as the staffing levels. If your staffing levels are really low, then the alarms, it's helpful, but in the end of the day, the alarm's ability to prevent a fall is only going to rest on the staff's ability to get to that person before something bad happens. So it's linked directly back to the staffing. Now, there's different types of alarms, and before I get into them, I want to say this. I've encountered several facilities recently that claim to be, in quotation marks, alarm-free, all right? They don't use alarms. There has been some literature that they can be viewed as restraints, and so they just made a decision facility-wide to not use them. I have a case now where my resident who had severe cognitive impairment was in a hospital with an alarm consistently on, and it had prevented several falls, and she transferred to the nursing home, and they don't use them. Now, no one explained that to the son, and they have this information, by the way, right? but they just elected not to use them. And you can envision what happened. Within 24 hours, she got up and she had a fall. So this idea that facilities, quote, just don't use them, close quote, I don't know about that. There is guidance to nursing homes about the use of alarms, and it says you should minimize the use, right? And you shouldn't use it as a substitute for supervision, okay? But there's nothing there that says you can't use them or don't use them. So if the resident calls for it, then you use it, all right? There's other tools that nursing homes view in the same way, right? Bed rails is one. They can't. It's not that they can't use them. It's that they're supposed to make sure that it's appropriate in that instance before they use them. So alarms are of this variety. Now, there's different types of alarms. One type of alarm is a bed alarm or pressure alarm. So it's basically a mat that rolls under the sheet of the bed that the person lays on. And when the pressure comes off of it, it starts to sound. Now, these alarms are really helpful if you have residents that are spending most of their time in bed but are apt to get up. These are very effective because usually these people are getting up to go to the bathroom and they're going to let the staff know, hey, they're getting up, right? It's not an instance where a person is already walking about. Now, suffice to say, most people that require alarms are not moving about quickly. So this should give the staff ample time to hear the alarm and respond to it and avert a disaster. Another type of alarm is a tab alarm or chair alarm. You see these. Kind of clips onto a person's clothing, and there's a little box that clips on usually the back of the wheelchair. And as the person sits up, and there's a little cord, and as it disconnects, it sounds the alarm. It's the same mechanism as a bed alarm. Basically, it'll sound the alarm, and the staff needs to respond to it. But this one, like I said, can work for chairs. I will tell you there's a product out there, because some people complain about the alarms, and say, oh, listen, the staff are jaded to it or whatever it happens to be. The alarm's purpose really is twofold. Not only does it notify the staff, but also reminds the person, hey, use a call bell light. There are alarms that record the family member's voice and remind them to use the call bell. So if you have these types of alarms, when a person goes to get up, whether it be a bed alarm or tab alarm, and the alarm goes to sound, you'd hear maybe your spouse or child's voice saying, Dad, don't forget to use the call bell. Dad, don't forget to use the call bell. I think these are pretty effective, and they've been on the market for a while. Why they don't use them, I don't have a good answer to that. I'm just telling you these are floating around out there, so if you're at a care conference, you can ask about these. There's another type of alarm where it's a mat on the floor, and the person gets out of bed and their feet go on the floor, then it'll sound the alarm and tell the staff, hey, get down to Jane's room. She's about to get up out of bed, right? There's also motion alarms. These are newer, where they sense a kind of motion and they will notify the staff that someone's up and about. So there's different products available out there. They all work differently. None of them are illegal or banned. I had a director of nursing tell me that a couple of weeks ago that they were illegal. I said, they're not. Ridiculous. The federal regulations are clear. They're not illegal. And so if your resident is appropriate for an alarm, those are floating around out there. Another common intervention, and this one is very simple, is to be sure the bed is in the low position. Most beds in nursing homes, they go up and they go down. All right. Now, having them down is important because this way it has really twofold purpose. If a person goes to get out of it, it's a little more difficult, and it might make them think to ask for help. But additionally, if they roll out of the bed, then they're falling much smaller distance than had it been in the high position. Okay, so you might ask yourself, well, why aren't all beds in the low position all the time? That's a good question. The reason is because the staff will oftentimes raise the bed when they have to do activities of daily living when they're with the resident. So that's not unusual, and it's a totally appropriate thing for them to do. So, for example, if they're coming in and they're dressing or they're doing something for the resident, they may want to raise the bed up because this way they're not bent over and putting their own backs at risk, right? But you have to remember to put it back down. I've had instances where they don't remember to to put it back down. So keeping the bed in the low position, especially when the person is not supervised, is critical. Another tool you can use is to put the bed against the wall. And in this way, a person will only fall out of one side of it. This can be helpful in addition with the next intervention I want to talk about, but that's another tool that's out there. Like I said, some facilities says we don't like to do that because it's a restraint. And I always think, well, why don't you ask the family about it? Because I think they will be the decision makers in this. And if they want it and they don't view it as a restraint, then let's go ahead and use that. The next tool I want to talk about works well when you have the bed against the wall. It's a crash mat. And when you have a person that's fallen out of the bed, which happens, a crash mat is just a mat that goes on the floor. It softens the blow because nursing homes don't have carpeted floors, and for good reason, right? It's a health issue, right? But a crash mat that's right next to the bed will prevent a fall, prevent an injury if there is a fall. That is, they fall on the crash mat, it softens the blow. Another tool you can use in this respect is what's called a scoot mattress. A scoot mattress, if you have a person that's tumbled out of the bed multiple times, or even if you think they're at risk of it, a scoot mattress is a little higher on the edges. And what it does is basically it's concave. So the person is in the middle at the bottom of the concave. And then if they roll too far, they're going to come up on the edge of the concave and they won't tumble out of the bed. And so ultimately, a scoot mattress is an option for a person who's at risk of tumbling out of the bed like that. In similar to the crash mats, but this is one that you would actually wear, they're called hipsters. Okay, it basically is like almost like you know, when I was a kid in high school, I played football. You know, we wore was called girdle. It had pads on the hips and pad on the tailbone, and this is a similar device that they wear. You can wear it under your pants, and basically this way, if you fall, your hip is going to hit the pad in between the floor. So it'll soften the blow. Hip fractures are extraordinarily common when you have these types of falls. And this particular intervention is directed specifically for that. I have seen instances where when there's a major concern for a head strike, people can wear like a helmet. In fact, I've seen that not just for the elderly, but that's another one in the same vein as the hipsters. Now, of course, another common intervention is to bring a person in a public area, either the nurse's station or a common area. Number one, it's good for them. They're going to be around people. They can talk to people. They're going to be around others, and that's good, right? But additionally, it puts them in an area where there's going to be an increased supervision. And so, my microphone just muted, so I don't know how long that's been going on for.
It just started, Mike, and they can edit this middle part out of the podcast, so you can jump straight back in.
All right, before I jump back in, give me one sec, because I was talking about the nurse's station, right?
Yes.
I'll go back and do that, and then there was something. Give me one second. Where is it? It's just gone from my brain. Hold on. Crash mats, hipsters. Oh, seat belts. That's it. Okay. Got it. Okay, you don't know where I clicked on, do you? Or clicked off?
It was literally like within 5 seconds of when you noticed.
Okay. All right, great. All right, so as we say in depositions, back on the record. So having people in a public space where they're going to be, there's just more traffic around there. So there's more of an opportunity if you see them getting up to redirect them to sit down. Now, of course, they're going to be in a wheelchair in this issue, if this issue presents itself. So there are some interventions specific to wheelchairs that I just want to finish with. The first is a special one called a high-backed wheelchair. A high-backed wheelchair actually is what it sounds like. The back is much higher. And what this does is it prevents people from going forward too far, right? They're leaning back a little bit. And so this particular intervention can be very helpful. Now, of course, you have to get a high-backed wheelchair. But trust me, the downside is catastrophic. So the facility should go about and get one of these things. So if you have a resident that keeps getting up out of their wheelchair, a high-backed wheelchair is an option for them. Another one's called a lap buddy. Now, what this is, it's literally a tray that clicks onto the wheelchair, and ultimately they can keep their things there, so they're not getting up for anything. Now, some people say, oh, look, it's a restraint. I say, well, that's all good and fine, but why don't you ask the family if they would like that? Okay, because ultimately, if it's going to prevent a catastrophic fall, I think they're going to want it. Or at least they should have that option or be able to make that choice instead of the facility making that choice for them. And lastly, and this one is really important to me, I had two friends that were close with me at various times in my life. Both were wheelchair bound. They were paraplegics. These were competent. One man was young, one man was older, but he lived independently. They had seatbelts on their wheelchairs, both of them, right? They both had seatbelts on their wheelchairs. I don't understand that when a person goes into a nursing home, they take these off. I don't understand it. I've been told, no, we don't use these. They're a restraint. Just so you understand, these seatbelts work like one on an airplane, where it just clicks together, and when you want to release it, you just pull up on the buckle, and it slides right out. Or I've seen Velcro ones as well. But I don't understand how these are restraints. I mean, there's testing that you can do with these to be sure a person can open them themselves. But at the end of the day, I've had friends who are completely intact, and they had seatbelts, both of them. And how now we have people that are at risk for falls and wheelchair bound, and we take them off, makes no sense to me, because I've had cases where not only people will get up and fall out of a wheelchair, but they slide out of a wheelchair and have injuries. So I don't understand this. It makes no sense to me. And I think if you do have a resident that's in a wheelchair, I would definitely ask about this and ask why they don't have a self-releasing seatbelt, because I'm telling you, these products cost about $10. And if that $10 can be used to prevent a hip fracture, immobility, bed sores, and death, then I think it's worth it. So that's something I would certainly ask about, are self-releasing seatbelts for your wheelchair-bound residents. Now, this list of interventions isn't exhaustive, but I've given you a lot of the main ones. Like I said, some of these facilities believe are controversial, but when I talk to family members, they're not controversial, right? People want these things. I mean, I've had instances where a family has asked for bed rails and was told, no, 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 we can't do that. I'm like, yes, you can. You can do it. There's an analysis you have to conduct, but you can do it. But ultimately, the family got to make that choice. And that's the way I believe it should be. If it's your spouse, your loved one, your grandparent, your parent, you should be the one making that choice, or the person should make that choice for themselves, not the facility in advance without telling the family that they don't use interventions that are known to prevent falls. So like I said, that list is not exhaustive, but those are the main ones. And so if you're going into a care conference, these are the ones I would suggest you ask about, because remember, a care plan has to be tailored to your loved one. Full stop. It is not one size fits all. And so asking about, knowing what the tools are in advance of that meeting can be very important to making sure that your loved one is going to be kept safe. So thanks again for your time and attention.